Agnihotra sacrifice. Cha, also. Agnin, in the fire. Yata vidhi, just according to the tenets of the scripture. Upbhuksha, fasting by only water. Upashanta, completely controlled. Atma, the gross senses and the subtle mind. Sa, Dhritarashtra. Aste, would be situated. Vigata, devoid of. Eshana, thoughts in relation with family welfare. Translation. On the banks at Saptasrota, Dhritarashtra is now engaged in beginning Ashtanga Yoga by bathing three times daily in the morning, noon, and evening, by performing the Agnihotra sacrifice with fire, and by drinking only water. This helps one control the mind and the senses and frees one completely from thoughts of familial affection. Purport. Srila Prabhupada. The yoga system is a mechanical way to control the senses and the mind and divert them from matter to spirit. The preliminary processes are the sitting posture, meditation, spiritual thoughts, manipulation of air passing within the body, and gradual situation in trance, facing the absolute person, Paramatma. Such mechanical ways of rising to the spiritual platform prescribe some regular principles of taking bath daily three times, fasting as far as possible, sitting and concentrating the mind on spiritual matters, and thus gradually becoming free from vishaya, or material objectives. Material existence means to be absorbed in the material objective, which is simply illusory. House, country, family, society, children, property, and business are some of the material coverings of the spirit, Atma. And the yoga system helps one to become free from these illusory thoughts and gradually turn towards the absolute person, Paramatma. By material association and education, we learn simply to concentrate on flimsy things. But yoga is the process of forgetting them altogether. Modern so-called yogis and yoga systems manifest some magical feats, and ignorant persons are attracted to such false things, or they accept the yoga system as a cheap healing process for diseases of the gross body. But factually, the yoga system is the process of learning to forget what we have acquired throughout the struggle for existence. Dhritarashtra was all along engaged in improving family affairs by raising the standard of living of his sons, or by usurping the property of the Pandavas for the sake of his own sons. These are common affairs for a man grossly materialistic and without knowledge of the spiritual force. He does not see how this can drag one from heaven to hell. By the grace of his younger brother Vidura, Dhritarashtra was enlightened and could see his grossly illusory engagements. And by such enlightenment, he was able to leave home for spiritual realization. Sri Narada Dev was just foretelling the way of his spiritual progress in a place which was sanctified by the flow of the celestial Ganges. Drinking water only, without solid food, is also considered fasting. This is necessary for advancement of spiritual knowledge. A foolish man wants to be a cheap yogi without observing the regular principles. A man who has no control over the tongue at first can hardly become a yogi. Yogi and bhogi are two opposite terms. The bhogi, or the merry man who eats and drinks, cannot be a yogi, for a yogi is never allowed to eat and drink unrestrictedly. We may note with profit how Dhritarashtra began his yoga system by drinking water only and sitting calmly in a place with a spiritual atmosphere, deeply absorbed in the thoughts of Lord Hari, the personality of Godhead. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. We were speaking yesterday about how this chapter, Dhritarashtra Quits Home, as well as the next chapter, The Pandavas Retire Timely, are full of emotion. They touch our hearts and make us feel very alive with bhakti. That is the nature of the Supreme Absolute Truth. Krishna is full of all the perfect emotional experiences. And in Krishna's interaction with his devotees, you see the perfection of emotion. Dhritarashtra has quit home. This is quite an extraordinary thing because he spent 80% of his life absorbed in mundane affairs, especially vicious intrigue. He was supposed to be king, but he was born blind. This is the way the laws of karma work. You get your mixed happiness and distress according to your past life. So he had the good piety in his past life to be king. But although born in a royal family and the eldest son, eligible to assume king after the death of Vichitravirya, he was also born blind, so that disqualified him. So this is a frustrating thing, and that is the nature of material existence. You never get a shot at pure happiness. It doesn't exist. We all long for that pure sense gratification, material ecstasy without problems. But such a thing does not exist. As soon as you have happiness, you must have distress. These are the laws of nature. Yesterday we were discussing the law of nature by which the weak are always dominated by the strong. There is no kind of economic or political arrangement that you can make to prevent this. It's part of the way the world is constructed. It's part of the pinching miseries of life. Similarly, there's nothing you can do to get pure material happiness. As soon as you say material happiness, then you're also talking about distress. Now, sometimes people get so frustrated that they can't have happiness without distress that they even say, yes, we need the distress because the distress helps us to appreciate what real happiness is. If we weren't miserable sometimes, we would never understand what it means to be happy. This is how low the standard of happiness is in material life, that you assert that distress is necessary to properly appreciate the happiness. Now, is that the kind of happiness you want? That in order to understand it, you have to have distress? Let's say you're walking on the street in a sunny day, beautiful California summer day, and then someone comes up to you and bangs you in the head with a stick. And he says, oh, why did you do that? That's to help you appreciate how wonderful the day is. What would you say then? Oh, yes, I really needed that. Thank you. In order to appreciate how wonderful the day is, I really needed you to smash me in the head with a bat. But people are saying like this, in order to understand what happiness is, you have to suffer a bit. This is how low we sink in the age of Kali. We're so arrogant, we have to justify our distress and our measly happiness in so many crazy ways. We have no humility. We can't admit, I really don't know what real pleasure is. I don't have the capacity to get real pleasure. I'm failing at being the supreme enjoyer. We were talking about this last night. It takes great humility to admit that Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead, and I am the supreme failure at enjoyment. But once we actually can think like that, we become peaceful. Why are we always agitated and disturbed? Why are we in anxiety? because we have this hope to enjoy, and we get frustrated because there's always impediments. So in our agitated state of mind, we're always trying to make adjustments. We're shaking this way, shaking that way. I want an arrangement in which I can be satisfied. My heart wants to be satisfied. My intelligence wants to be satisfied. My body wants to be satisfied. So what's the world going to do about this? Then we look around at all our associates. What are you doing about my satisfaction? What's the purpose of your existence? Are you adding to my pleasure? If not, if you aren't adding to my pleasure, then what's the use of you? In fact, if I can perceive that you're contributing to my distress, this is the greatest offense. If you're not going to give me some pleasure, at least be neutral, but don't ever cross me. So this is how we analyze our social affairs. This is how we analyze our environment around us. What's it doing for me? When you wake up in the morning, you can catch yourself. Try this experiment. You wake up in the morning, and as soon as you open your eyes, is the first thing you think, oh, what's the day going to have in store for me? How am I going to be treated today? How does my body feel today? What are the opportunities today for bodily comfort? And what are my anxieties? Is that the first thing you think? Fortunately, because we have the deities here, Shishi Rukmini Dwarkadesh, as soon as you wake up, you can immediately think, oh, now I should run and take a shower and chant Hare Krishna, come to see the deities in the morning. This Mangal Aarti works, you know. After some time, you'll begin to see that you actually like to get up in the morning and see the deities. Especially here in New Dwarka, the deities are worshipped so opulently. It brings joy to the eyes, joy to your life, to see the grandeur of the deities so early in the morning. And that way you get off the day, you get into the day off a good foot. From the very beginning of the morning, you're spiritually optimistic. Your mind is saturated by the majesty of the deities. In comparison, which our problems and anxieties seem so tiny. And then you chant your japa. So nice to have a chance to concentrate on the holy name. And then there's greeting the deities and guru puja. You can dance in jubilation before Srila Prabhupada and the deities. So doing these things makes us realize, actually, my anxieties aren't very important. And you notice, as soon as we back away from sadhana bhakti, as soon as we back away from the deities, immediately, shroom, our problems assume monstrous proportions. Oh, what about this? What about that? I'm not getting this. I'm not getting that. I'm not appreciated. I'm not being paid attention to. But as soon as we come before the deities regularly, chant before the deities regularly, dance before the deities regularly, we realize Krishna is the important one. How is Krishna getting pleasure? And even us Rakshasa-like entities from Kali Yuga can become purified of the desire to be the supreme enjoyer. And this is what's giving us problems. So Dhritarashtra, he spent his whole life in intrigue. How to deprive the Pandavas of their kingdom, and how to put his sons, his own men, in charge. This is the essence of the bodily conception of life. Dhritarashtra says it right in the first verse of Bhagavad Gita. What are my men doing, my people doing, as well as the others, the Pandavas? So, in the battle of Kukshetra, he lost everything. 100 sons, all his associates and political cronies, is every chance at ruling finished completely. Yet, his desire to enjoy was so deep that he lived in the palace of Yudhisthira in imaginary royal grandeur. Now, actually, Yudhisthira was treating Dhritarashtra like he was royalty. Yudhisthira, from his side, felt compassion on his uncle and aunt Gandhari, how they had lost all their sons, they had lost everything. So Yudhisthira from his side was treating them indeed like they were great royal personalities. But Vidura had something else to say. Vidura came back from pilgrimage, and all the Pandavas were ecstatic. Their dear uncle Vidura had come back. So Vidura had a particular purpose. He was speaking Krishna Katha for the benefit of the whole family, but particularly he was gearing on Dhritarashtra. What are you doing here? Don't you have any shame? Here you are living in royalty in the very house of the persons you did everything to kill. Don't you have any sense of Kshatriya integrity? How can you do this? Now, it's not that Vidura was simply trying to arouse some sense of self-esteem in Dhritarashtra. The problem is more than no self-esteem. This is how materialists try to respond to problems these days. We have to build your self-esteem. No matter what, if you're born in an affluent family and you're not doing well at school, we build your self-esteem. If you're born in the ghetto and you're dropping out of school, we build your self-esteem. In all situations, build the self-esteem and everything will be all right. Think good about yourself and good will come to you. So, Vidura had better things to do than that kind of thing, building Dhritarashtra's self-esteem. But he was using the Kshatriya sense of honor as a way to get Dhritarashtra to listen. Just like Krishna, he did the same thing with Arjuna in Bhagavad Gita. For one who has been honored, dishonor is worse than death. Don't think, Arjuna, if you walk off this battlefield that everyone will think you are being very magnanimous. No, they'll consider you a coward. So the Lord in Bhagavad Gita is using all kinds of motivation, because Bhagavad Gita concerns ultimate surrender to Krishna as well as the temporary dharma of the body. So, Vidura, he's saying like that to Dhritarashtra. Have you no shame? You're living in the house of the very persons who you tried to kill, and they killed all your 100 sons, and here you are living comfortably. Get out immediately. This is Vidura's message. Get out immediately, because time is coming and it's taking everything away from you, and you can't do anything about it. There is no political or economic adjustment that can be made to stop time. So he emphasized this point to Dhritarashtra. Immediately do something. And then he began to analyze Dhritarashtra's physical condition. Just look at you. Your teeth are falling out. Your memory is gone. Your liver is malfunctioning. You're coughing up mucus. You're already blind, so we can't say your vision's failed. So, you best get a move on. What should you do? What is the solution Vidura offered? He said, someone who is actually dhira, undisturbed, leaves home and gives up their body in a remote place, unknown to others. Now, to the modern ear, this sounds horrible. You mean, I'm going to grow old and just to go off somewhere alone and give up my body in a remote place? How cruel. It is natural that as you get older, you want more and more comforts for your body. That is the natural thing. You start to slow down. You are looking for where there is peaceful, secure arrangements. But just when you start feeling like that, what does the Vedic system say? Out you go. Pancha Stordvam Vanambraje. As you're nearing 50, right around that time, 50 years old, you must go to the forest. Notice how the Vedic system goes completely against the grain of material conditioning. First of all, when you're a teenager and the senses are very vibrant and strong, lust is boiling in your body, your senses are alive, and you feel like you have a whole career of unlimited sense gratification just opening up to you. The teenage years are like that. But at that time, the Vedic system prescribes austerity. Tapasa brahmacharyena, samena cha dhamena cha. At that time, there's celibacy and there's sense and mind control. So in the classical Vedic system, of which we don't have today, the men, most of them, they marry at the age of 21, and the girls, they would marry at 12 or 13. In that way, everybody's senses were controlled according to a very fascinating system, which doesn't exist now. What do you have now? As soon as you become 12 or 13, immediately you try to enjoy your senses as much as possible without restriction, and then people expect they're going to have a very nice, peaceful society out of all that. The Vedic system says, when you're youthful and your senses are so wild, that's the time for austerity. Go the opposite way. Modern culture says, when you're youthful and your senses are raging, then rage. Get into it. I remember when I was 14, my father, he thought I wasn't really adapting to the world properly, so he wanted to give me some loving advice. So he took me aside and told me, son, life is not a spectator sport. I can see that you're just watching and asking a lot of questions, but that's not the way to live life. You've got to get into it. Just don't sit on the sidelines and watch. Immerse yourself. So this is the demoniac way of upbringing. You've got senses. Get into it. Do things. So teenagers totally absorb themselves in the raging of their senses, and modern society tells them this is the way to go. The Vedic system is something else. You're feeling the passion in your body as a teenager? Take up austerity. And then after your teenage years of austerity, the man can marry if he chooses. And for the woman, as a young girl, she's entering the teenage years. The body is pushing in a certain way. All right, you take a husband. This is the classical Vedic system. We don't have that today. We have complete hell in the name of civilization. And then people wonder, why have two boys in Littleton, Colorado, gone on this horrible killing in high school? Why? How could this happen? Oh, my God, what's become of our children? What do you mean, what's become of your children? Look at your society. You'll see why they're acting like that. We were discussing this last night in Bhagavad Gita class. Why should those young boys not have done what they did? They live in a society which says there's no supreme controller, there's no karmic reactions. Be happy as you feel best. So they took it to its natural conclusion. They said, we'll be happy by killing our schoolmates, and then we'll kill ourselves. Why not? This is what gives us joy. The whole society is geared in that way. However you feel happy, do it. This is the greatest wisdom that parents can give their children these days. Well, however you feel good, then that's what you should do. As long as you're happy. I asked so many teenagers, how do your parents give you advice? They all say the same thing. Well, my parents just feel, as long as I'm happy, it's all right. I ask, especially teenage boys and girls, I ask, but the girls, suppose your father and mother hear that you're shacked up with some guy. Well, they'll just say, as long as we're happy and we're not doing anything really disruptive. This is the standard these days. Do what you like. Do what you feel in your heart, as long as it's not disrupting others. But these guys in Colorado, their happiness was disrupting others. They felt, this is going to give us great joy. The newspapers, they describe these guys are going to classroom in their school in total delight, blowing people's heads off. And people are wondering, how could they do that? Well, why not? If happiness is whatever you feel, then they were doing whatever they felt to be happy. And in the end, they killed themselves. That's all part of it. But the crazy materialists, they're scratching their heads. How could this happen in an affluent school? I mean, if it was in a ghetto school in L.A., yeah, well, that's another thing. But affluent, Colorado, super high real estate values, land of skiing. How could this go on there? What's wrong with our society? Are we meant to put metal detectors and security guards throughout our most affluent, successful schools? But what is so successful about your school system, whether it's affluent or a ghetto school? The same kind of monsters are coming out. We're not mystified by these things. So these two boys, you know, they thought, you know, we're going to have a good time. Something Prabhupada said explains this whole thing. Once he, Prabhupada was on a walk in Vrindavan, and he turned to the devotees, and he asked them, what is the greatest pleasure in the material world? So, of course, you know what the devotees said. You know, they heard enough lectures by Prabhupada. They knew what the number one material pleasure is. Oh, of course, Prabhupada, yes, you know. Sex life, that is the greatest pleasure in the material world. Normally, Prabhupada would agree, but he wanted to add a special hidden insight this time. So he said, no, actually not sex life. The highest pleasure in the material world is killing. You feel, he didn't explain, but you can understand, you feel great pleasure and control and power just terminating somebody and watching them just suffer and die in front of your eyes. It gives you a sense of pleasure. I'm the controller. I have power. I'm dealing with life and death. So Prabhupada said, actually, that is the greatest pleasure. And you can see in the activities of these two young guys. They're just going from classroom to classroom. The witnesses describe them. They were delirious with pleasure. They would blow someone's head off and then look at the remains and say, oh, awesome. Yes, very grotesque. But this is the result of the society that's raised them. And yet, the very crazy people who were responsible for such a society, their parents, the government, they stand around, oh, how could this happen? Oh, what's becoming of us? This is the very mess they've made. Why should anyone not behave like that? There's no God. There's no reactions to your activities. There's no heaven, hell, or spiritual world. Do what you like. That's what these two boys said. They went up to one girl and said, do you believe in God? She said, yes, I believe in God and you should follow his path. They said, there's no God. Blam, blew off her head. They're just taking what they've learned from society and all the music they've heard and the science education and coming to the logical conclusion. There's no God. We can blow off your head and there'll be no reaction. And we can even kill ourselves, and that's the end of us, you know? There's no reason to conform to any rules or regulations except what you feel. And what is the music that these guys are listening to? Music put out by society, freely available, for a price, but openly available in any music store. Music like, there's no such thing as good behavior, there's no such thing as God, just evil has already taken over the world, so you might as well get into the evil. That's the music they're listening to. These are bestsellers. These are not just weird, you know, CDs that only, you know, weirdos buy. This is the mainstream music. Evil has taken over the world, so you might as well get into it. If someone, you know, taps you on the shoulder and you don't like it, blow their head off. That's what the music is saying. And yet people are wondering, how can this happen? So the Vedic system, of course, is something else. It says, all right, you've got these wild teenage bodies. You have to take up austerity. But it doesn't end there. The next powerful stage of bodily influence is old age. And many of us, especially Prabhupada disciples, were heading for that. For a fact, a lot of us Prabhupada disciples were feeling relief that we made it through the teenage years, we made it through the 20s and 30s. Finally, the senses are starting to die down a bit, and we're starting to feel settled and comfortable. But no, the next challenge is coming. Old age, what are you going to do about that? Naturally, when you're old, you want to take it easy. Sit back, give advice to the young ones. Yeah, do you remember? I remember. Sit back, give advice to everybody and reminisce. But no, the Vedic system, once again, has got something in store for you. You've got to go the opposite way again. Just like you did according to the Vedic system when you were a teenager, you went the opposite way against your material desires. Similarly, when you're getting old, you've got to go the opposite way. Instead of settling down in comfort, you have to increase your austerity. This is really hard to understand. I'm an old man. I'm entitled to relax now. The Vedic system says, no, now is the time to take your game up another notch. Go on another level. You've got to go against the grain. So that's what Vidura is telling Dhritarashtra. Get out of home. Don't stay here. Leave for the north immediately. Otherwise, that time is coming, Kali Yuga, which will diminish all good qualities. In other words, Vidura is saying, if you don't leave now and you just wait around for Kali Yuga to come, the influence of Kali Yuga is so great, you're going to forget everything I told you. So you got to go now. So Dhritarashtra, he listened. He actually did that. And this is a miracle, considering Dhritarashtra's lifetime of he wasted on materialism and intrigue and political power. Vidura gave him his mercy, and therefore Dhritarashtra left. Now, the Pandavas were also there listening to Vidura's lectures. The lectures weren't specifically meant for them. Nevertheless, of course, what Vidura is saying applied to everyone. Nevertheless, the Pandavas, they were so elevated that whether they left home or stayed at home, they were perfectly Krishna conscious. Still, to set the example, the Vedic system is going on, and you'll also see the Pandavas leave home. They're Kshatriyas, so they don't take sannyas. They just headed off to the north. But, factually speaking, they didn't have to leave home. They were always with Krishna. Vidura is always Krishna conscious. The Pandavas, they are situated in fraternal love of Krishna. Krishna has his friends in Vrindavan, and he has his friends in Dwarka and Hastinapur. What does it mean to be a friend of Krishna? To always be confident of Krishna's protection, and to always be confident of Krishna's friendship. So, Yudhisthira, Bhima, Arjuna, Nakula, Sahadeva, they're all friends of Krishna. Draupadi also. Nectar of Devotion describes Draupadi as fraternal love of Krishna. Friendship. So, when the Pandavas would meet Krishna, Yudhisthira would treat Krishna like an inferior. He would smell Krishna's head like an elder. And Bhima and Arjuna, they would treat Krishna like an equal. They would embrace. And Nakula and Sahadev, they would bow and touch Krishna's feet because they're younger. But actually all the five Pandavas, they are in friendship love of God because they're roughly speaking the same age as Krishna. They treat Krishna sometimes with great casualness, like Arjuna. He would lay with his head on Krishna's lap and would laugh and joke with the Lord. This is the nature of fraternal love of God, in which the activities of friendship overpower any feelings of awe and reverence. Of course, in Vrindavan, there you find the most casual friendship. Just like when Krishna's holding Govardhan Hill with his left hand and his friends are saying, "Ah, you've been holding that hill too long. Will you please transfer Govardhan Hill to the hand of Sri Dama and let him hold it so you can take a rest?" And then they say, "Well, if you don't think Sri Dama can handle it, then at least transfer Govardhan Hill from your left hand to your right hand so that we can massage your left hand. Then you can bring it back from the right hand to the left hand." These are Krishna's friends. They're thinking themselves equal to Krishna. Okay, you can hold Govardhan Hill with your left hand. So can Sri Dama. Krishna, you've held it enough. Now let Sri Dama take over so you can rest. While the Pandavas are relating to Krishna in friendship, Dhritarashtra has left home. And we discussed yesterday how painful this was for Yudhisthira. He blamed himself What have I done? Have I offended them? Have they gone and drowned themselves in the Ganges? And then Narada Muni appears and tells exactly what's going on, and that's what's happening today. Narada Muni, with his vision, he can see what Dhritarashtra is doing, and he's relaying that to Yudhisthira. He's practicing Ashtanga Yoga. He's going through the mechanical yoga process. And in this way, he'll be able to fix his mind on Hari. Now, actually, because Dhritarashtra was an offender, Vidura could not turn him into a pure devotee of the Lord. But Vidura started him on the path with the preliminary yoga system. He started him on the approach to pure bhakti. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also talks about Ashtanga Yoga. And Krishna talks about bhakti independent of any other kinds of yogas. So, the Ashtanga Yoga is an approach to bhakti, but bhakti can exist on its own without it. And in fact, if the Ashtanga Yoga is to be successful, you have to get to the pure bhakti. So Dhritarashtra is just beginning his career in self-realization. And because he's an offender, he can't immediately take up pure devotional service. Still, Vidura gave him some mercy. So Dhritarashtra is now practicing the mechanical yoga system with the goal of fixing his mind on Krishna. He's left home at such an old age, and in 5 days later, according to Narada Muni's vision, he's going to give up his body, and Gandhari is going to walk into the fire of her husband's yoga powers. Through yoga, he's put his body into flames, and he's disappearing. Gandhari will walk into that fire. Why? Because she feels the flames of separation to be more intense than the flames of the fire. So these things are going on in this chapter, great emotion and great incentive for us to understand that we also have to prepare to give up this body. And as we approach the age of 50, we have to be thinking. The yellow light is flashing. Old age means death is coming. Now is the time to increase our devotional service. We can see in the life of Srila Prabhupada, we cannot imitate, but according to our measure, we have to follow generally in his footsteps. When he was 50, he began to walk away from his family life. And he struggled, practically speaking, for 20 years before any successful preaching happened. Successful in terms of quantitative results. For 20 years, he struggled. Just try to see Prabhupada's situation. Right when he was hitting his 40s, his late 30s and 40s, in the prime of his life, he was encumbered, on the one hand, by an excruciating family situation. His wife refused to help him preach. And at the same time, the Gaudiya Math had fell apart. He saw the powerful, mighty mission of his spiritual master just dissipate in front of his eyes, and meanwhile at home his family life's oppressive. Then when he was around 50, he began to more or less call it quits with his family life, although it slowly completely wound down over 5 or 6 or 7 years. But basically by the time he was 50, around 1946, that was it. So for 20 years, from 46 till 65 or 66, no appreciable preaching results. 20 years. So sometimes we complain, no one's joining, or this or that. But 20 years, Prabhupada struggled. He described himself as crying alone in the wilderness. This is how he spent his Vanaprastha years, from the age of 50 onwards, struggling on his own, simply trying to carry out the mission of his spiritual master. So, we cannot imitate. Yet, the Vedic system prescribes that we also, as we approach our old age, we have to increase our austerity. increase our dependency on the Supreme Lord and dedicate the last phase of our life for trying to achieve the objectives of our spiritual master. Any questions? Yes. If you have strong sex desire, then, according to the Vedic system, you marry and you follow the regular principles. And in that way, you can bring into the world Krishna-conscious children. Take up the family responsibility, and then at the right time, you still have to walk away. There's no great mystery about that. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Dharma viruddha bhuteshu kamosmi. I am sex life according to religious principles. I mean, I don't have any experience, but I heard Prabhupada say, you can experience Krishna in this way. So what is the mystery about what to do? Of course, you have to be a qualified husband. That means you have to be able to take the dependents and your spouse. You have to be able to give help in going back to Godhead. Anything else? Yes. There can't be morality without God. This is what so many of our parents have tried. Just be a good citizen, just be a good human being. But you're left at the mercy of the modes of nature, and they drag you down, and you begin to think very Maya. If there's no God, there's no controller, and there's no reactions to what I do in the next life, what does it matter? Anyone will start thinking like that. Why should I be a good citizen? Why should I follow morality? Give me one good reason. The good of society means me. I want to enjoy. Sure. I mean, if I can steal and engage in all sorts of sexual affairs and do anything I can to please my senses, why shouldn't I? Give me one good reason why I shouldn't, since it's a godless morality. Why should I think that the good of society is some abstract conception? That's what all the music these people are listening to says. Don't worry about all that stuff. Just, if you feel angry, kill. If you feel lusty, have sex. Don't worry about anything. Why shouldn't I think like that? It doesn't matter what I do. There's no reaction. So all that talk about godless morality never works, because you're left at the mercy of the nature. You must be dragged down into passionate ignorance. Yes. All glories will roll out.